There is a lot going on in the news these days, and it can be difficult to make sense of it. Morning Edition is working around the clock to help you navigate your questions, to keep you informed, to bring you voices you might not otherwise hear, and to provide expert insights and historic context. As long as you still have questions, we will keep asking them. So be connected. Listen every weekday to Morning Edition from NPR News.
Morning Edition, weekdays beginning at 4 a.m. Central on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our radio Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. And today we're going to begin our show talking about an important transition in our state. Claudia Berg is retiring as the director of the State Historical Society of North Dakota. Her last day was June 30th. And Bill Peterson is starting as the new director of the State Historical Society of North Dakota. His first day is today. Bill, welcome to North Dakota.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Claudia, what brought you to the Historical Society 39 years ago?
A job. I had graduated from college, and we had from the University of North Dakota, and we had moved to Bismarck, where my husband became a resident with the Arts Council in the elementary school system. So I was looking for a job, and the Heritage Center was opening, the original Heritage Center, and there was opening for a graphics designer and then an exhibits curator. And so I applied, and I have been there ever since.
And you've been the director since 2014. Bill, tell us about yourself. You came from Arizona.
I came from Arizona. I've spent a big chunk of my career in Montana, and I grew up in Michigan, so I've been involved with museums and historical operations since the mid-90s and was fortunate enough to land in Bismarck, North Dakota recently.
And I note you have a doctorate in American Cultural Studies from Bowling Green State University. So, Claudia, how would you characterize the state of the State Historical Society as you leave?
It is in great shape. It's over the last 15 to 20 years, we have really been concentrating on building up the infrastructure across the state with new interpretive centers in the Four Corners, cultural heritage re-grant program for our county and local museums across the state and communities as well, and then the expansion of the Heritage Center, both with state archives, storage, and then with the bigger expansion that opened in 2014. So we've really laid the groundwork for heritage tourism across North Dakota. So I feel like we are just on the edge of the platform, diving into all kinds of new experiences to bring the state forward as a national destination with all the resources we have across the state, our historic sites, our parks, our natural landscapes. We are a great destination, and I think across the northern border, the northern Great Plains, we're in the center of kind of the exotic place in the country. I think we have a lot to offer, and I think visitors are starting to recognize us as a real opportunity and a unique experience.
Bill, this is your first day, and you've been in transition, I assume, for a little while here. But I would think a historical society is sort of unique wherever you go. Tell us about your adaptation to this new place and its mission.
Oh, well, thank you for asking. I'm just thrilled to be in North Dakota. It's a part of the world that my wife and I have loved for a long time. And I think one of the things that made it so wonderful is just the North Dakota State Historical Society has just a sterling reputation among historical societies and particularly among people that do state and local history. So it was just a real thrill to be here and start to see all of the scope and everything that is represented by the Historical Society. So as Claudia mentions, so not only is there a excellent opportunity for tourism, but just a great launch pad to continue the work that's being done here and demonstrate the value of history to the people of North Dakota and its visitors.
Claudia, the Historical Society is headquartered in that Heritage Center on the Capitol grounds. It's a beautiful building, and that's literally, though, kind of the tip of the iceberg, isn't it? I mean, you're everywhere, and you've got lots of stuff.
That's very true. We have 57 state historic sites. 10 of those have interpretive centers or museums across the state. And then also with our North Dakota Studies program, it's the fourth and eighth grade are all digital. They're on our website, and they're used by thousands and thousands of people and students every year. And we're finding people from around the country and the world are using that site to become more familiar with North Dakota before they visit.
Well, Bill was named the new director back in March before the pandemic went into full gear. Claudia, how has the work of the Historical Society been affected by COVID-19?
Well, we were closed for a little over 3 months, and so but what's happened is, though people can't physically or couldn't physically visit the Heritage Center or our sites, they were going online. And so our numbers, especially with the North Dakota Studies website, have just skyrocketed. And so people are still learning about North Dakota history, experiencing the past, but also, you know, inspired about our future. And now that we opened a week ago, reopened the Heritage Center, and then most of our historic sites opened on Memorial Weekend. So we're welcoming visitors now, and it's all going very well. It's staff being home for that period of time. There was some portability to a lot of their work, so they were doing a lot of data entry and research, and the collections people and research people are thrilled to be back in the building with the hands-on work that they love to do.
Bill, I've been trying to decide which face mask I will frame when this is all over as sort of my artifact of the pandemic of 2020. What is the Historical Society going to do to preserve this piece of history?
Oh, good. That's a great question. You know, we're considering a lot of things. There's an online initiative to share your pandemic stories, your COVID-19 stories with us so that we can record some of those histories. We'll be doing probably some active collecting of objects outside of this, like we've done with other things that impacted North Dakota over the ages. So just a kind of slow and steady, just keep doing what we're doing and what we've been really good at over the years.
Bill Peterson is the new director of the State Historical Society of North Dakota. Claudia Berg is newly retired in that role. Claudia, how is the Historical Society funded?
The majority of our funding comes from state appropriations. And so every 2 years we go in and talk to both the House and Senate in the Appropriations Committee, but we also have a foundation, and they are a partner in raising funds for specific and special projects. And we have friends groups associated with most of our major sites. They also raise funds for specific projects on those particular sites. So there's a number of ways. There's also grants that come in. We also have our federal program, our State Historic Preservation Office, and there are some federal funds that come in to support that operation as well. So there's kind of a mix of resources, but we really do very much appreciate the state support we get through the legislative action.
I suspect that you've got a list somewhere of things you'd like to do. Are there sites or artifacts or proposed collections that await funding?
Well, there's always a long list of historic sites improvements that we'd like to take on and new initiatives. There's always collection care that needs to happen. We'd like to be updating all the exhibits out at our historic sites now that we have the exhibits at the Heritage Center completed. They always need updating and rotating of objects. But there are a few initiatives that we really would like to undertake at Whitestone Hill and also at Fort Totten with Native American communities, and addressing the past and reestablishing some interpretation at those two sites and moving forward into the future where we can take that. We're also looking at the Chateau with the planning in place for the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library in Medora and what that will do as a destination. And there are several pretty good sized projects that we would like to undertake at the Chateau as well to meet that influx of new visitors, which is pretty substantial anyway every year as the major destination in North Dakota.
Well, Bill, now that you've been handled the baton in this relay, what's your vision for the Historical Society?
Oh, well, Doug, that's a great question. Partly we're going to expand on the remarkable record and growth of the State Historical Society of North Dakota, but I think we're really going to be able to show the people of North Dakota and the surrounding areas the value of having a historical society like the one that they've got. It's just these things, access to your history will strengthen communities, it strengthens states. It's just a great way to promote 21st century learning and critical thinking, communication, collaboration, and creativity. So we're just excited to really build on the foundation and continue to show that this is a true value for the people of North Dakota.
Claudia, you mentioned all these sites and the archives and the collections and things that exist under your purview, under Bill's now. There are county historical societies across the state as well. I know Cass County has one, and Clay County has one across the river. They're both very interesting places. Is there interaction with these county societies? Is there a formal relationship between the state and the county on these?
Yes. We have affiliate agreements with a great number of the county historical societies, which leverages a mill levy for them, so they do have some income coming from their county. Our re-grant program was reignited with some funding in the last session, so there are grants available that way that take care of anything from a leaky roof to collections care, exhibits, and programs. We're also initiating something new with the Main Street Initiative, where we're working with teachers that are teaching North Dakota studies, and then working with the Main Street Initiative, which is one of the big governor's initiatives, and really getting kids curious about their own communities and really getting them instilled in their own communities in a pride of place and becoming engaged citizens. So it's a wonderful opportunity that is just really kind of igniting on Main Street now and in communities through North Dakota studies. And so across the state again, we're just really excited at all the potential that's before us. And I really hope to continue doing some of that work with some of those communities in the years to come.
Bill, as you may know, the North Dakota Capitol was built during the Depression, and it's the tallest building in the state. And as I learned last week in a discussion with our news director, Dave Thompson, they're currently dealing with an American with Disabilities Act issue. They've got to widen doors so that they're wheelchair accessible, something that I thought would have been done a long time ago. But one of the issues is preserving the integrity, the architectural look of that space. So let's talk about how historical societies make decisions about what to preserve and how to preserve it.
Oh, okay. That's a great question. So are you talking specifically on the Capitol?
No, I'm talking in the broader sense of this.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a great question. You know, generally, we try to preserve things. Of course, our mission is North Dakota history, so we try to preserve things that were impactful in the history of North Dakota and meaningful to its people. And sometimes those decisions are made partly outside of the organization, and sometimes those decisions are made largely from within. So curators and public historians, archivists, making some of those. We are mandated by law to preserve some things. So we function as the state archives, so we preserve the records of the state government. And then on the historic preservation side and our archaeology side, you know, we preserve knowledge in many cases about things that were here before or things that are currently on the built environment, and we show people how to access those. So it's a lot of moving parts as to what is preserved and how. But generally, we try to preserve things that have the most impact for people in North Dakota.
Claudia, I noted that last week there was an announcement about a couple of structures that were going to be put on an historical places list. One of them was Our Lady of the Annunciation Chapel in the University of Mary campus in Bismarck. I didn't realize that it was the work of master architect Marcel Breuer of the Bauhaus School in Germany, famous guy, and also the Harvey Power Plant, which hasn't been used in almost, 65 years.
Yes. It's the National Register Program is just a wonderful opportunity for landowners, for homeowners, for building owners. And the University of Mary Chapel is just stunning. It's you're driving by it, and it looks, it's kind of that brutal architecture where it's very heavy and it's concrete. For those who might not know a lot about that style of architecture, it might seem not so interesting, but once you get inside of that building, it is just stunning. And it is interesting, that international architects have worked in the Northern Great Plains in North Dakota. It's a wonderful experience to see what architecture can do to help explain spaces and places in history. And the other example, also a lot of concrete in it, is that Harvey Power Plant. That it has a wonderful history. And I talked to some people in the Harvey area that remember as kids seeing it operating. And the owner of that building now is so excited to have it on the National Register, and he's restoring the building and doing the best he can to retain the original architecture and flavor of that building. And you'd asked about, changes, and it's the kind of thing, you have to make buildings work for today's uses as well. So there's always latitude for creating adjustments. And a lot of times it's those exteriors that are the really important part to retain the original look and feel and intent. And that would be nice for the interiors as well, but also knowing that needs change and taste change as well.
Bill, we were talking about how the Historical Society might retain images and ideas and stuff about the pandemic. It strikes me that there's an instructional opportunity here by putting up an exhibit about what the state did during the Spanish flu epidemic of over 100 years ago.
Yeah, I haven't delved into exactly what is in our collections regarding that, but I'm sure that there's a particularly represented in the archives how the people of North Dakota dealt with the 1918 influenza epidemic. And there's, of course, there's certainly coinciding material that of the same era that would have been in the collection side of things, but there's certainly some similarities to draw probably between the two time periods.
Well, we welcome you to your new position. This is Bill Peterson. He's the new director of the State Historical Society of North Dakota. Thanks for joining us today, Bill.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Claudia Berg, the newly retired director of the Historical Society. Congratulations, Claudia.
Thank you so much.
Coming up on Main Street, some more history from Tom Ezern.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by North Dakota Living, celebrating more than 65 years of featuring the great people and places of North Dakota, and proudly serving the members of North Dakota's electric and telephone cooperatives.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton.
Tom Ezern is well known by the State Historical Society of North Dakota. He's a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University, with a resume filled with restoration projects, scholarship, and lots of writing. He's the author of Pacing Dakota, a collection of essays about our state's unique heritage, and he's the writer and voice of our Plains Folk essays. Today, he continues his research into folk songs from generations ago in a piece titled The Boys on Duck Creek.
Don't ask me my name, an old bachelor I am, and I bet all the same I've an elegant plan. You'll find me out west in the Duck Creek Plain, starving to death on a government claim. I'm back on the trail of that iconic and ironic folk song of the Great Plains, starving to death on a government claim, also known as the Lane County Bachelor, also known as a homesteader's lament, and now, from the standpoint of Southwest North Dakota in 1910, the government claim. Previously, I tracked this lively anthem of weary homesteaders to its first known appearance in print in the Emmons County Record in 1894. Well, as settlement spilled west across the Missouri River, so did the song, to be embraced and relocalized in new places. That reference to the Duck Creek Plain. Duck Creek is an intermittent tributary of Cedar Creek. Duck Creek Township of Adams County is northeast of Hettinger. As the editor of the State Line Herald, a newspaper published in Lemon, but on the north side of town, and thus not in South Dakota, but in North Dakota, as the editor explained when he published the version from his locality, printed by request, it is a sample of what the boys used to like 3 years ago, but it's all changed now. From this we gather that the song was circulating in Adams County, North Dakota in 1907, when the boys were having a hard time on their homesteads, but that things are all changed now. Evidently by 1910, the boys were willing to forgive the U.S. government and the Milwaukee Railroad for bringing them to what seemed like hell on earth. But they did not wish the grasshoppers, bedbugs, drought, and starvation of the earlier time to be forgotten. The boys evidently were settlers hailing from Indiana, since their final chorus goes, "Farewell to this country, farewell to the West. I'll travel back east to the girl I love best. I'll stop in old Hoosier and get me a wife and live on corn dodgers the rest of my life." A generation ago, an eminent scholar of American folklore, Jan Brunvand, published an exhaustive study of the song I'm talking about in Heritage of the Great Plains, a journal published by the Center for Great Plains Studies, Emporia State University. Brunvand had two main conclusions. First, that the song originated in Lane County, Kansas, probably during the 1880s, although not published until later. From there, the song drifted south to produce hardy offshoots in Oklahoma. This is so. I agree that the Kepner text, written down in the 1890s and deposited in the library of Fort Hays State University, is the source closest to the song's origins. Second, Brunvand argues that the literary history of the song was mucked up by amateurish folklorists who grabbed traditional texts, messed with them, then sang and published them, interfering with the folk tradition. What Brunvand doesn't point out is that the folklorists believed they were working with settled literature. They did not understand the frontier still prevailed on the plains, and they were messing with living folk tradition. Brunvand fails to consider the possibility that the song might have migrated north as well as south with settlement, which it did. I have other versions from the northern plains, too. Or that some northern smart aleck, with the advantages of optical character recognition and digital communications, would come along to second-guess his meticulous research.
That's Tom Ezern. Coming up, Tom Brousseau talks about the upcoming third episode of The Great American Folk Show. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. North Dakota's information technology director says his department is using money from the CARES Act to buy equipment as the state continues to move toward employees working remotely. Telework expanded because of the COVID-19 pandemic. IT Director Sean Riley told the legislature's Interim Information Technology Committee his department is spending $10.5 million on new equipment.
We are purchasing a little over 6,000 devices, 6,000 laptops for across the state to be able to continue to enable telework and social distancing. Along with that, there's in the neighborhood of 9,000 monitors to be deployed. There's docking stations, hardware for cameras. We have new camera systems that are going into many of the conference rooms. So a huge amount of equipment that is exploding out across the state.
But Riley told the committee there have been some problems getting all the needed gear delivered.
Unfortunately, there is still very much a supply chain problem worldwide. We cannot get the amounts of equipment that we need comprehensively yet.
Governor Burgum has said he will have some recommendations on some state employees continuing to work remotely even after the pandemic eases. A bit of good economic news for our area. The Mid-American Business Conditions Index is now slightly above growth neutral for the 9-state region, including North Dakota. An index of 50 is neutral. The June index was 50.3. For North Dakota, the index climbed to 51.6 from May's 43.4. Dr. Ernie Goss of Creighton University publishes the monthly index. He says the negative numbers are getting, as he put it, less negative.
Sort of crawling out of the recession, but we'll have to see a lot more months of above growth neutral numbers to be confident that we're actually moving back to something before pre-COVID-19 levels.
Goss says the surveys indicate a flattening out of employment with only slight gains over the months ahead.
We are seeing consumers getting out more. We're seeing businesses opening up more. We're seeing leisure and hospitality, where this recession began, is opening up, but we've got a long, long way to go before we see a real opening of the regional economy and the North Dakota economy and the U.S. economy.
Goss says the trade numbers are still pretty dismal, as are the numbers for oil production and price. And the city of Emerado, just west of Grand Forks, is battling overland flooding today after an overnight storm dumped 8 to 10 inches of rain on the area. Kari Gels is director of Grand Forks Emergency Management.
All of Emerado is flooded. All around Emerado is flooded. So yeah, we're going to have some recovery work to do. We've got a lot of basements. Some are completely full of water. Some, you know, has 6 inches. But as you know, 24, 48 hours, the mold starts to grow, and it's going to be 100 degrees. So this is going to be a mess.
Gels says most, but not all, roads in the area are barricaded and some culverts are damaged. County Road 13 is flooded in 4 different spots. County Road 3, south of Emerado, is damaged. A National Weather Service report says 8.37 inches of rain fell southeast of Emerado, while an observer in nearby Arvilla reported nearly 10 inches. Flooding has caused the Grand Forks Air Force Base to temporarily close its commercial gate off Highway 2, with that traffic now being directed to the main gate. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Hi, I'm Bill Thomas, Director of Radio. And the Prairie Public Radio team and I have always been proud of our mission to serve you. But we're even more proud and more committed to be your home for critical news and information during the ongoing global pandemic, the unrest, the national conversations necessary and long overdue as they are. And thank you to all our contributing listener members whose generous support makes Prairie Public possible. Thank you also to our sponsors who have stuck with us during these unprecedented and challenging times, like Valley City State University, NODAC Insurance, and the Blue Moose Bar and Grill. I hope you'll get the chance to thank them too. When you do, tell them you listen to Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. This weekend, we celebrate Independence Day and what we love about our nation. For singer-songwriter Tom Brousseau, that's the Great American Songbook, which is the inspirational core of the show he created and hosts, The Great American Folk Show. Episode 3 airs Sunday. He spoke with Main Street's Ashley Thornburg.
Tom, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on again.
So episode 3 is coming right up, and you have a wonderful mix again of really quite famous, including Academy Award nominated actor John C. Reilly making his second appearance on the show. And then you have this lovely inclusion of local famous like Joe Wiegand, who is well known as a Theodore Roosevelt repriser, and then our beloved chef Andrea Baumgardner. And then, of course, you have musicians Eleni Mandel and Kenneth Patinale and Letitia Van Zandt. Nice mix of how you feeling about it.
I feel pretty good. You know, it's been really interesting kind of reaching out to people and asking them to be, you know, a part of the program. And I find that a lot of people do want to be a part of the show and are really interested in being a part of a program like this. But then everyone has their own schedule, and a lot of the folks on episode 3 and on who will be on future episodes, right now they're so busy doing projects similar to this podcasts. And then, you know, every musician now has really become so technically savvy or proficient, and they're hosting their own programs like this on their, you know, Instagram accounts and Facebook pages. So I feel pretty lucky just being able, you know, to get the mix of people that I've gotten so far. Feel pretty grateful that, you know, that they've wanted to be a part of the program.
How do you end up sort of pitching the show? Do you approach these people just as other creative professional and, hey, do you want to chat? Or do you have to sort of give a spiel of what your show is and talk them into it?
I think a combination of everything you just said. You know, in the process of putting the show together with Bill Thomas at Prairie Public and Eric Dethridge, I've had to really boil down what it is that I'm trying to accomplish. And so I find that that's, you know, that's leaked over, spilled over into how it is that I approach artists and folk artists to come on the show. On episode 4, I'll just tell you an example. A bluegrass legend, singer and songwriter and yodeler, Peter Rowan, is going to be on the program. And I don't know him. I've been a fan of his for all my life. And a lot of my musician friends, the more accomplished musician friends of mine, do know him. And so I feel like I know him, but he doesn't know me in any way. In order to ask some of these people to come on the program, a lot of it is just cold, kind of like cold calling. You know, I figure I have about a paragraph to write, and then I send that to some of these people, and I kind of just hope and pray that they respond. And in Peter Rohn's case, he responded right away. I felt like my prayers were answered. Some other folks I've had to kind of go through their, you know, management and agency, which is definitely the more appropriate action to take. But I'm still very, I feel, I don't want to say immature, but hopeful in that, you know, that people will find the meaning in just me reaching out to them before I, you know, go the route of going through their management.
I suppose it must be a difficult time to be management in this case, because you're managing schedules from a very different perspective. And I guess I don't know if you tend to book your own things or what your, you know, if you have an agent or management or how that works. So I guess has it been weird, do you know, from a management perspective?
In this particular time and age, with, you know, our current situation, our outbreak, and our political situation, I think that it's been trying, I think, for a lot of people. I mean, you have the artist aspect, and I think every artist that I know, all they want to do is do their thing. If they're a painter, they want to paint. If they're a singer-songwriter, they want to write. If they're a performer, they just want to get out there and get on the stage and do their thing. And then, of course, on the other side, you know, you have the management and agent and booking side, and they want to do their thing. They want to book. They want to get their artists out there on the road. And, I think it's just a difficult time all around. But one thing I think we all can say is, you know, in times of difficulties like this, people really do get creative.
Yeah.
And, you know, the boat doesn't stop. I find that that's the thing about human beings is that we find other routes to make it happen.
Yeah, whether or not we're making a living professionally, creatively, we are pretty creative as a species.
I think so, yeah. I think, you know, bucks aside, we are still just so totally geared to find, I suppose, that road.
Yeah. Well, one person who is on your show, obviously everybody here is doing their work in a different way, but since I am personally familiar with how Andrea Baumgardner is running her restaurant a little bit differently in these times, because I live and work in the town where her restaurant is, let's talk about Andrea Baumgardner, because she is a James Beard nominated chef. She runs a beloved eatery in Fargo that people definitely come across the state to go and eat at. Now, I think if memory serves from last time we talked, you haven't been there yet, but you knew you wanted her on the show?
My mom called me.
Okay.
She is really good friends with Andrea's mother. And she said, you know, what you should do is you've got to call Andrea Baumgardner and get her on the program. And I've heard of Birnbaum's for a long time, and my mother has talked about it, and lots of my friends have talked about it. Some of my professional colleagues have stopped there and eaten at Birnbaum's. I haven't had the chance to do that yet. And so actually, despite the fact that I know who she is, and I just have this immense respect for her, and also I know from other mutual friends who've traveled through the area who've stopped and dined at Birnbaum's. It was my mother. And I find my mom does this a lot. She has all these great ideas. You should get this person on the program. You should get that person on the program. She also has ideas, I might add, for me on what songs I should write next.
Moms are
so
good.
I guess
at that, aren't
they? I guess what I'm saying is, everybody who's listening out there, don't forget to listen to your mothers.
Well, what'd you think of the Andrea segment?
I loved her segment. In my mind, when I have first conceived the show and, you know, kind of developing it with Bill Thomas and Eric Deathridge, what I wanted was people just to be as off the cuff as they possibly could, and the show is not scripted. And so to have Andrea, you know, for her to be able to find the time, which I really appreciate, and sit down and give this really lovely little monologue, I guess you would say, on her restaurant, almost like she was just talking into her personal diary, it's a pretty special thing. And I swear, I don't know if she has dogs, but I think that I can hear dogs in the background kind of waiting for her to get off the dictaphone so she can, you know, play with them. So it's, you know, some of these monologues are really personal and they're intimate, and that's you can't ask that of anyone. It just is, it's going to happen or not. And in Andrea's case, it's just a really lovely piece from start to finish.
Well, her approach to food is very much something out of love. And it's not an exact quote here, but she says something to the effect of, to give something time is a way to send love out into the world. And she has this, she's talking about making matzo ball soup, which is something that is apparently not technically difficult, but the timing has to be perfect. You have to pay attention. And I just thought, well, what a metaphor for life that is. It doesn't have to be difficult, but you have to pay attention sometimes.
It is so very true. You know, that applies to the arts. You know, in a similar way, Pete Seeger said, anyone can sit down and write a song. It's honestly not that difficult to do. I think it's something we all can do. But what you do need is you need the time and the patience to put into it to make it good. And that's just exactly what, you know, Andrea is saying in her piece. Yeah. And in a similar way, I'm friends with a chef out in Los Angeles whose name is Mary Sue Milken. And she says the same thing. At some point, you know your stuff. You know how to do it. You've done it 100,000 times. Now it just comes from the heart. And I think this is something that, you know, Andrea Baumgartner has come to in her own professional career. And I can't cook to save my life, but the sentiments that she expresses in her piece, I feel just on a deep level, and I think a lot of people will too.
Well, you mentioned that the idea to get her on for a segment came from your mom, and your dad has been very involved in the show, a number of his short stories. There was Mickey the Dog, I believe, in the inaugural episode, and then now there is another one, this time again read by actor John C. Reilly. And I'm curious, have you talked to your dad about what it feels like to have his short stories put out there? I mean, and this is not an actor whose resume is like corpse number 7 on Law and Order. This is, you know, John C. Reilly.
Yes. And, you know, John on the first episode reading one of my father's stories, and then another John Doe reading Mickey the Dog on episode 2. And now John Reilly back again, you know. I think that for my father to have, here's what it's like. It's like, I don't really know what my father thinks, but I can equate it to this. Some of the songs that I've written have been performed by other people, and there's really no greater compliment than having somebody else interpret your work and kind of bring it to light that way. So I can imagine he's, at the very least, feels pretty darn flattered, you know. But the short stories are, you know, getting to know my father kind of more as an artist now, and he's been a doctor his whole life, and it's been, I've found this just whole new appreciation to the man and as an artist, and the stories are so good, and I think they have special feelings to them, and I guess I really don't have a point to make other than, you know, I appreciate having family involvement in this program.
Do you compare notes, how to write a song, how to write a story?
No, I don't think so. But in a way, we kind of do. You know, my father, since I was a kid, is always telling me, you know, this song is a good song, that song is a good song, referring to, you know, the great American songbook that we have here in America. Songs like My Funny Valentine or The Ink Spots, any song of The Ink Spots or The Mills Brothers, songs by Al Jolson. You know, he will, when I was growing up, will say, come in here and listen to the song Maria from West Side Story, you know, and he'll point out certain parts of the song. So he has indicated my whole life what he feels is just original when it comes to writing, and special, and, you know, those notes I've kept pretty dear to me. And I suppose, although I don't know if I do it consciously, I know that I go back to them quite a bit, those notes from my dad on, you know, songs from the Great American Songbook.
Well, I have interviewed you in advance of both episodes 1 and 2, and now, of course, episode 3 that airs this Sunday at 5:00 Central on Prairie Public. And for episodes 1 and 2, the conversation took place after the show had been edited, and so I was only hearing the final product. This time, just because of time constraints and schedules, we're talking before the final show was sent to me, but I got to hear all of the clips that are in it, but not necessarily in the order. And then they're a little bit rough. There's restarts in there. So I very much got a behind the scenes peek at putting together the show, which just, you know, this won't help the listeners at all, but it was really nice for me to hear a little bit of the process of how you put the show together. And one thing that really stuck out to me is you have actors and actresses and musicians on the show. And for example, you have the great singer-songwriter Eleni Mandel, and she sings these songs and then she is restarting on the songs, but there's a couple times like she misspeaks, but she doesn't restart over. And then you have John C. Reilly, who is more known as an actor than as a musician, but he sings and speaks. He doesn't restart in the song ever, but he restarts in his monologue. And I just thought that was fascinating that you could kind of tell that they were both good at both, but there's maybe a little bit more passion with one or the other.
Yeah, and that they're human, and, you know, the materials that come to me are they're raw, and
yeah.
In Eleni's case, she's such a great example. This is kind of how people are going to be hearing Eleni Mandel, is how she is. She's unapologetic and confident, and, you know, it's... As someone who studies performers, it's really good to see that, because it takes a lot of pressure off. I think as performers, we think this has got to be perfect. This has to be within a certain time. Am I going to, you know, are people going to like me? You know, you start off thinking that way, but eventually you just start really believing in yourself. And so any imperfection is perfect, I would say. And that's the way that Eleni is. And if anything, I think it just adds, she becomes all the more mythological or, you know, mysterious, or I'm not sure what it is. And it also feels like this is something that I can do when I see somebody who's human, who's being real. Then I think to myself as a listener or as an audience member, okay, this is something that I can do. You know, and maybe what I mean by that is I can relate to this.
Yeah. There's so much of being a creative that is just giving yourself permission.
Yeah.
The announcer for the show, Joe Wiegand, is quite famous as a Theodore Roosevelt repriser. In this case, for your show, he's doing the announcing, and now he's doing a segment called Notes from the Badlands. Do you know, does he have plans to appear as Theodore Roosevelt?
Maybe. I hope so. You know, if you know Joe, you know, if you know Joe's work, he looks an awful lot like Teddy Roosevelt.
And, he really does.
And he probably sounds a lot like him too. So I think I'm really just honored to have him part of the program and to have his Notes from the Badlands be, you know, in any way associated with the program.
Yeah.
Because he's a performer, and I think that he's not monolithic. He's not, you know, he doesn't wake up and say, oh, good morning, Teddy, to himself in the mirror. You know, I'm sure he's got a great singing voice, and he's probably a painter for all I know. I'm sure he's a dancer. I mean, I think this is a man who's a jack of all trades, a lot like John Reilly, you know. So right now it feels really good to be able to have him on the program as the official announcer and to have this segment that he's written, Notes from the Badlands. But I got to tell you, I'll be darned excited to have him on as Teddy Roosevelt one day.
Well, we hope so too. Tom, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Ashley. I just appreciate you having me on.
Tom Brousseau, who created and hosts The Great American Folk Show, speaking with Ashley Thornburg. Episode 3 airs this Sunday at 5 p.m. Central. Dakota Datebook is next.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Before highways, there were trails, and the Red Trail is North Dakota's original auto trail. When you drive the old Red Old 10 scenic byway between Mandan and Dickinson, you will enjoy fascinating countryside and meet friendly folks. Load up the family in your car and experience a legendary journey on the old Red Old 10. More information at the Old Red Old 10 Facebook page or online at oldredold10.com.
This is Dakota Datebook for July 1st. North Dakota's legislative business is usually done on a tight schedule, no more than 80 days every 2 years. But sometimes, special sessions are necessary to patch budget shortfalls, to reconsider funding, or to redistrict the legislature. There have been 15 special sessions in 130 years. Governor Ed Schaefer called a special session in the summer of 1994 to consider state tax incentives to attract a $260 million corn processing plant to the southern Red River Valley. Minnesota and South Dakota also were bidding for the facility. The special session got underway with a skeleton crew of legislative employees. A bill began the hearing process in the House and then the Senate. For new businesses, it offered a package of property and sales tax exemptions on construction materials, machinery, and other items. The Republican-controlled House passed the bill 95-0. The Democratic NPL-controlled Senate passed the bill 47-1, which Governor Schaefer signed 2.5 hours later on this date in 1994. At the bill signing ceremony, Schaefer said, quote, "This is a good bill, and it's going to be beneficial for the state of North Dakota no matter what happens," unquote. The only lawmaker to vote against the bill expressed concerns that the package was too sweeping and might affect school district funding when city and county commissions negotiated for big projects. Finalists for the factory were the cities of Hankinson and Wahpeton in North Dakota and Big Stone City in South Dakota. Wahpeton got the project in March of 1995. At the time, North Dakota's legislature was meeting in regular session. State representatives gave away bottles of corn syrup to celebrate. Then Representative Jack Dalrymple announced the news to applause on the House floor. The Bismarck Tribune editorial board hailed the plant as a bonanza for North Dakota's economy, given the construction work plus 150 new jobs and $7 million in annual wages. In May of 1995, ProGold broke ground for the plant north of Wahpeton. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Jack Dura. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
In Ohio, the residents of a small community are determined to put on their annual 4th of July parade. But social distancing will make this year's parade unique.
So what it is the units are stationary and motorists drive through the parade.
Finding a safe way to celebrate Independence Day on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street, and a reminder that as we broadcast, we stream at prairiepublic.org. And after the broadcast, you can always find any Main Street show at prairiepublic.org. Thursday on our show, reviewer Matt Olien returns to talk about his favorite movie stars. Mark Trahan comments about the national debate over mascots and symbols. Sue Balcom drops by for Main Street Eats, and Eliza Blue shares another postcard from the prairie. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Thursday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.